what's going on in the Capitol and how it affects you. State Senator Tony Wong joins Melissa in the morning right now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
In his first executive action since being reelected to a second term earlier this month, Governor Lamont announced he is calling the Connecticut General Assembly into a special session so they could extend the duration of cuts on gasoline taxes as well as bus fares. They also wanted to talk about some other things like heroes pay. So that special session is starting today. It has to come out with answers before December 1st because, for example, those bus fares and the gas cuts, those are expected to end on December 1st, which is Thursday. So joining us now for more of the details, what's going to be discussed up in Hartford, is Senator Tony Wong. Good morning, Senator Wong. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. And I hope everybody had a wonderful and healthy and happy Thanksgiving. I'm still trying to recover from eating way too much.
You and I think everybody else, Tony. I totally understand. I'm glad that you and your family, though. It sounds like you had a nice Thanksgiving.
We had a wonderful time. We count our blessings, and we're grateful for what we have.
Good.
And we helped out others that are in need. To kind of clarify, the governor did call for a special session, but this is a legislative body of the old legislative, not the newly elected one. So all the old legislators, ones that have retired or moved on, even the ones that may have lost, are responsible for coming into this special session.
Right.
And I think it
Thank you for clarifying that. Yeah, because I do think there are some people who thought the person they voted in was going to be part of this, but they have not been sworn in. That won't happen until January. So, yes, thank you for clarifying that, Senator Wong.
Absolutely. And it is an important special session. It addressed the issue in regards to extending the bus fare relief to May. To allow people more flexibility to be able to get to locations and hopefully to work. It also will extend the gas tax exemption, but it's a phase-in. It was due to end. The 25-cent gas tax relief ends December 1st, but we are going to address the issue in phasing in a 5-cent increase from December to May. So it does not get rid of the tax, but it's a slow phase-in, which restores it back to May, the 25-cent gas tax. So it does not relieve it. It does not eliminate it. It's just a slowly phasing in.
What do you think about that, Senator Wong? Because I know that it costs millions of dollars a day to eliminate it altogether.
Well, it's an issue of how we spend money.
Mm-hmm.
Supposedly, the excise tax should go into the special transportation fund, which we all agree needs to address the transportation needs, the infrastructure transportation needs of our state. It's absolutely critical in our rail systems. But the problem is we don't have the discipline in our budgeting to allocate that specifically, and we use that money for the general fund. That has been one of the biggest struggles we have is we talk a lot about surplus, rainy day surpluses, but the reality is we don't allocate money collected from taxes from hardworking Connecticut residents into their proper slots.
Mm.
So we don't budget properly, and that's the crux of my struggle with any additional excise tax. We've been able to live without the 25 cents excise tax, and how nice is that as a relief for an unaffordable Connecticut?
Yeah.
But again, we're going to go back to it. It's another taxation. It's money on the people without the discipline of government to responsibly spend every penny we get from people.
Yeah.
So when we talk about that, it's a tax that we've been able to live without.
Mm-hmm.
And my preference is we tax too much in this state. And we need to create more discipline and more effective allocation. Budgeting is about priorities, and unfortunately, in some aspects, our priorities have been misplaced. But in this special session, we're addressing issues that the Republicans, the Senate Republicans, have raised in August of last year,
in
June,
mm-hmm.
talking about how we need to reallocate priorities. So the three areas that we're going to talk about, a reallocation of priorities, is one, the low-income home energy assistance program, mm-hmm. called the LIHEAP, which is a federal program, but we subsidize it in the state. Now, we woefully have underfunded it because of increased oil cost to homes throughout the state of Connecticut. When you look at $6 oil per gallon, it was sticker shock, but it was also pocket shock. So what we're going to do is increase funding from the state, conditional upon the federal government increasing the allocation for the LIHEAP program. So we're saying we will stick up in the state of Connecticut, as we should, to ensure that the cold winter months as we come up, people will have heat and be able to have the oil availability.
So how much money are you, or not you, Senator Huang, but like our Senate Republicans hoping gets invested into this program? Because especially we know that the prices are going to go up for the two major utility companies. We know that both Eversource and UI are going to get their price increases as well. So how much money are you guys hoping you see put into this fund?
We're looking to commit about $135 million, which is roughly where it was funded last year with the federal supplements. But at the moment, the program is funded at about $102 million. So this will only, the additional state funding that we're going to vote on today would only kick in if Congress did not provide the additional federal funding.
I see. Do Democrats and support that, going back up to that 135 that you had mentioned, even though we don't have the money, like the federal money? Do they support upping that? Because they were upset about the price increases for Eversource and for UI as well. They were very upset about it. So I would think you'd get bipartisan support on this, no?
You will absolutely get bipartisan support. I think the only grudgingly commentary you'll get was, we should have done this in June. We should have done this
a long time
August.
Ago. Yeah.
You know, this urgency, and I've said many times, you know, politics should not get in the way. If people have good ideas, whether it be Democrat or Republican ideas.
Right, just go with them. Why are we,
But the arrogance of party politics,
party rules,
election politics, and one-party politic control says, it wasn't an issue. But, amazingly, we're going to address it now. But I'm glad we're doing it better late than never.
Yeah.
So you're right. We need to kick in the money, and you will get bipartisan support. So that is the LIHEAP program.
Okay.
And that is important. I fully support that we have a responsibility to make sure that every household is kept warm and safe in these winter months coming up.
Senator Huang, only because we've got 5 minutes, I want to make sure we get to all items being discussed in Hartford for this special session. But really quick, who can get help from this home heating assistance program? I know you guys are all hoping to put millions of dollars into it, which is great. But would middle class, upper middle class residents of Connecticut even be able to pull from this fund?
Well, there are income thresholds and eligibility requirements, and anticipating that, Melissa, we have put in a direct link onto my website related to home energy and electric assistance resources and criteria and measures
website?
And how you can apply online. So people can go to SenatorHuang.com, and there's a direct link to the state website that gives you that information and criteria.
Okay, I'll be checking that after the show.
Everybody is very much ready to see the eligibility. And I think one of the things that the Senate Republicans have asked for is expanding the eligibility, because particularly in southwestern Connecticut, we have many, many residents that are cash poor, asset rich, meaning properties and our seniors who are property owners that have tremendous assets in their real estate, but they're not very liquid and they have struggling fixed income. We have to address that. And so one of the questions that I've asked for is to expand the income threshold, particularly accounting for our seniors and young families that are struggling in this state in so many aspects of affordability. but that the, people can get the criterias not only for the oil heating, but also for electricity assistance as well, mm-hmm. given the utility increases that we are not addressing in this special session today.
Okay. All right. Okay. And then the other two things, and by the way, again, that is Senator Huang. If you want to go to his website, there's a direct link, actually, because I just checked it out. If you go to Senator Huang's website, there is alleviating high home heating oil bills and electricity bills. And when you go there, it checks if you're eligible before you fill out that application. So go there. You never know if you are eligible or not. So check it out. In the meantime, what else are you going to be discussing during this special session, Senator Huang?
One of the issues is hero pay for all of those private sector employees, such as our healthcare workers, who are the heroes on the front line in COVID, our truck drivers, our grocery workers, all the deemed essential workers that went to work during these very difficult and challenging times. One of the things we looked at in the last year's budget was to look and allocate about $30+ million to fund that. Even at that debate, Melissa, I said $30 million is woefully inadequate to compensate for our workers who left their families and put themselves at risk. I think we need at least about $120 million to effectively compensate and acknowledge the contributions of private sector workers. The state employees will get their hero's pay through negotiations, in addition to the lucrative new budget, new contract that they got. So this is about private sector workers, and we're looking at putting some additional money. I know the new controller had looked at $90 million. We're looking at putting in an additional $60 million, so we could get up to $90 million. But nevertheless, there's controversy in what is deemed as hero pay. That is going to be a topic of conversation. But nevertheless, I think we have, at least in my opinion, that those workers that put themselves at risk in this COVID pandemic that we endured, I believe that they should be acknowledged for their contributions, for their sacrifices, and for the risk that they took. So I am fully in support of acknowledging that they need to get additional compensation of an acknowledgement of the risk that they did in maintaining essential services for the state. But at our original budget of, I believe, $30+ million, even in the budget debate that we had, I thought that was woefully inadequate.
I agree.
I'm glad we're going in to address that.
And when you think about the fact that there were double the amount of people who applied for it, and really only half of them even were given the green light, yes, you've qualified for it, to then find out that we're getting $233 checks, I think is just infuriating. And I know I was one of those people who did not qualify for it, even though we applied. But I just thought for the people who literally did make the cut and they were expecting, like, wow, okay, here's 2 months worth of my income or whatever, and it was cut down to less than half of it. I mean, it was pretty astonishing. Would you say that was because they were not anticipating that many? I know when there was the child tax credit, the governor kept coming on the show saying, wow, nobody's applying for it, no one's applying for it. But with this, the system was overrun for weeks with people applying. Do you think that they just didn't allot enough money because it was based on how the child tax credit went? Why were we so short on having the money promised to the heroes
pay? There's two parts in my mind. I think, one, it was definitely a topic of negotiations and debate and compensation for state employees in the discussion. Our private sector employees were pretty much an afterthought in my debate and frustration. The second part of the frustration of why I believe it's necessary to compensate them is the fact that these individuals never got a COVID ARPA check. Remember?
Right. I do remember.
These
yes.
individuals continue to work, so they were not eligible for the largesse of the
yep.
COVID ARPA unemployment allocations that were provided and the checks that were being mailed out. So these people stuck it out, did the essential work, and I think it is appropriate to call them heroes. And these are unsung heroes. These are the truck drivers.
Right.
These are the grocery store workers. We've acknowledged the frontline healthcare workers, absolutely incredible yeoman work. But there's so many others that provided essential services to keep services available for us and our economy going. And they needed to be acknowledged. And in my mind, that is woefully due.
Yeah.
So I have no problem with it. There may be some people that says this is kind of creating more of a kind of an entitlement system, and
I don't think so. I think even as somebody who didn't qualify for it, I think it's an effort to even the playing field, because I think while I have a lot of friends who are state workers, and I was very happy for them that they got the money, because what people don't realize is that state workers hadn't seen a raise in quite some time, and that they too, a lot of them are frontline workers, our state workers. So, you know, like our state police, who we have a shortage of, our DCF workers, I mean, those are people who also were frontline workers. So I wasn't upset to see them get the money that they did. They deserved it, with or without the pandemic. But I think this was at least a start at evening the playing field for people who are in the private sector. So
I agree.
Yeah.
And we talk about budgeting in the early part, as I said, and I kind of repeat this ad nauseum, is the fact that budgeting's about priorities.
Yeah, exactly.
And we had a priority in my mind in the budget debate that we had in June, that we needed to take care of our essential workers in the private sector.
Yeah.
That being said, I'm glad we're stepping up to it, even though it may be 6 months or 8 months late. But nevertheless, I think it shows that what we said as Senate Republicans in June and July should have been addressed and are now being acknowledged. And I think maybe, if nothing else, begrudgingly, we will look forward to support these special session legislation. But my comment would have been, we should have done this
a long time ago. Senator Wong, unfortunately, we have run out of time, but it sounds like I'm going to go with an educated guess. It does seem like there's a lot of bipartisan support on all of these fronts, which is
without
a good thing.
Without a doubt, bipartisan,
yeah,
because it is trying to create a more affordable Connecticut.
Yeah.
Because right now, with energy costs that are skyrocketing, we have to create solutions. This is a short-term solution.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have to get to long-term sustainable solutions. But nevertheless, right now, and we said it over and over again, is Connecticut right now is unaffordable for most people. And that is critical as we go through this upcoming new year in the budgeting. And it is. Budgeting's about priorities. And unfortunately, some of the priorities were misplaced, and I'm glad we're finally getting in there to fix it.
I agree. Senator Wong, good luck. Certainly keep us posted on the special session, and I'm sure we'll be talking to you really soon.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too. That's State Senator Tony Wong here on WICC. Read accounts of animal cruelty, each after close to 200 cats were found in a home here in Connecticut back in June. And, you know, we've seen a lot of stories like this, hoarding situations, specifically animal hoarding situations in Connecticut. So we wanted to talk about this. Is it a trend? Are we seeing more people doing it? And when I say trend, I don't mean something you want to jump on. I mean, are we seeing more of these cases popping up? And if so, why is it happening and how do we stop it? Joining us this morning for the first time is Virginia Maxwell. Virginia is a professor of forensic science, and she is talking about crime scene investigations after a 15-year career at the State of Connecticut Forensic Laboratory in the Trace Evidence Section. So good morning to you, Virginia, and thank you so much for coming on WICC.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you very much for having me.
First of all, Virginia, tell us how these animal hoarding situations happen. Of course, every case is not the same, but typically what are we seeing happening that it ends up being a hoarding situation?
Well, animal hoarding really is defined by four main things. First of all, you know, and first and foremost is the accumulation of large numbers of animals. But added to that are that the conditions in the environment, whether it's a home, whatever the particular area is, are deteriorating. And then the second factor in it is that the individual is no longer providing minimum standards of sanitation, of space, of nutrition, grooming, veterinary care for all of the animals they have. And then we go to number three, which is really they don't really recognize what the effects of their failure are having on the animals. Also, there may be other human members of the household. They don't recognize what it's doing to them, and they don't recognize, you know, what is happening to the environment around them. And finally, they either in complete denial of the problem, or they minimize the problems and the living conditions for the people and the animals.
I mean, is it, how often is it that people really just don't realize, oh, wow, I've gotten out of control? Like, it's hard to imagine a house of 200 cats where you're like, wow, I didn't realize my four cats have now become hundreds. Or am I looking at it too small? And that's okay. If I am, please tell me.
Well, hoarding is really considered to be a mental disorder. So it is not normal behavior. And then on top of the fact it is characterized as a mental disorder, there are then subcategories of hoarders. It's not a one-size-fits-all type of problem. And we consider that there are three general types of hoarders that are out there. First one we would call an overwhelmed caregiver. The second one is called a rescue hoarder. And the third type is called the exploiter hoarder.
Okay, so what are those types of hoarder? Like, how do you define those, or what do those mean?
Well, they're very different. First of all, the overwhelmed caregiver, in some ways, is probably the most benign out of the three. And they're someone that started off with good intentions. They probably had a few animals. They probably looked after those animals pretty well. And then generally it's considered that some sort of major life event takes place for them, whether they lose their job, whether there is death of a loved one, whether they themselves are diagnosed with a serious illness. And this then starts to get out of control, particularly if some of the animals in the home are unaltered. They haven't been spayed or neutered. Plus, other people may drop off animals with them. And so it really spirals completely out of control. They're beyond their ability to care for them. The rescue hoarder is someone who generally poses as a rescue organization. And they're more tricky than the overwhelmed caregiver because they truly believe that they are on a mission to save as many animals as possible from a presumed threat. For them, it's often euthanasia. And so while they may care for their animals, they're not able to take care of them. And then they start to obsessively collect additional animals that they feel also need to be rescued.
Wow, that's unbelievable.
And then the final one, and they, you know, they may even register as a rescue, and they may also have a network of people who are enabling them by finding more animals for them. But probably the worst of them, the hardest one to deal with, is the one that we call an exploiter hoarder. And these individuals have no level of compassion for their animals at all. They don't care about the animals. They are acquiring animals for their own needs, for their own purposes, and they have no emotional attachment to the animals. They're also often very clever. They're very charming. They have no guilt for the condition of the animals. They are mainly out to get what they can for themselves, whether it's soliciting money from people. And we can even look at, you know, puppy mills to some extent in this category, backyard breeders in this category, where it's all about what can I get from that animal. So those are our, you know, our three main categories. And, of course, they require, as you might expect, a very different approach.
Yeah, no question. Virginia Maxwell is here this morning, professor of forensic science at the University of New Haven, also with a 15-year career at the State of Connecticut Forensic Laboratory in the trace evidence section. We're talking about hoarding situations, animal hoarding, to be specific. And so, Virginia, would you say that we're seeing more and more of these cases pop up in Connecticut or nationwide? Or are we about the same as it's always been?
You know, I think what happens is we're starting to hear more about them. Mm. It may not necessarily be particular increases in them, but, you know, we're certainly hearing more about them, you know, particularly when they're fairly high profile, when there are large numbers of animals. But, you know, it certainly is an ongoing problem. I mean, I think it is probably fairly wider spread than we may realize.
Wow, interesting. So how do we curb the issue? How do we fix this? Because the thing that I'm hearing is that a lot of times these are not people who are looking to hurt animals necessarily. A lot of times it seems like they don't even recognize that there's a problem in front of them, and it sort of spirals out of control. It kind of reminds me of like when you have a shopping addiction, and I'm not comparing, you know, coats to animals by any cost, because listen, I'm a huge animal advocate. I'm always sad to see these animals in hoarding situations, especially because a lot of them do end with either horrible illnesses or defects or even animals being found dead in these homes. But you have people who are going to serve time in jail, paying lots of fines, and you have animals that continue to be in horrible situations. So how do we fix the problem, especially when it could be something diagnosed earlier than after a hoarding situation, if that makes sense?
Yeah, no, it does. Well, I think the first and foremost, I think we need to realize the animals are suffering. They're suffering terribly because these are extreme neglect situations for the animals. So they are emaciated. They may not be getting much in the way of food and water. They have parasites. They have diseases, you know, all manner of things. So the animals are suffering terribly in these situations. And also they are breathing in very high levels of ammonia. So they have lung issues, breathing issues. So I think we certainly shouldn't minimize the fact the animals are suffering terribly. But, you know, how do we spot hoarders? How do we find them? Well, you know, generally there are signs. You know, the home is deteriorating if it's visible. I mean, there was a hoarding situation actually quite near where I live, but the house was not visible from the road. But, you know, the home is deteriorating. The person themselves may have somewhat of an odor of ammonia and things like that. Animals that are visible will be emaciated. They'll have behavioral issues. The individual may have become very isolated from the community and may be appearing to neglect their own particular needs. And also, you know, as I mentioned earlier, they're in denial. So even with the most visible signs of it, they may say, oh, no, my animals are all absolutely happy and healthy. As far as veterinarians go, you know, is the person constantly bringing different animals? Are the animals always young? Do they go to half a dozen different veterinarians if they're going at all? Some of them do have one or two favored animals that might get some veterinary care. So, you know, those are some of the signs. As I mentioned, the exploiter hoarders will sometimes be the puppy mill operators, the high volume breeders. And so anybody, you know, the best thing, of course, to avoid those is to adopt and not be buying, you know, going to a pet shop to buy a dog or a cat or a pet from there, because often those are coming from the puppy mills and the high volume breeders. But if you are going to a breeder, do they let you see where their animals are kept? You know, can you meet the parents of the puppies, you know, or the kittens and things like that? So, you know, look for signs like that, that generally people are evasive. They don't want you to see where they live. They don't want you to see where they're raising their particular animals. So those are the things, you know, that might be some of the tip-offs for it. And if somebody does have a suspicion that, you know, a friend, a relative, a co-worker even, because hoarders can be out there, they can be very high-functioning. If you have any concern, you know, the best thing is to see if the person is willing to accept help. And if you're fairly certain there is, you know, a hoarding situation and the person is not receptive at all, then the best thing is to involve animal control or law enforcement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and certainly go with your gut. Like Virginia said, if something seems off and you approach the person and you don't feel it suffices, always, you know, look for authorities or animal control to get involved. You know, you'd rather be safe than sorry and know that, hey, I made a wrong call versus checking or just kind of bypassing it and going, hey, it's not my problem, so we're just going to move on from it. So, Virginia Maxwell, I really appreciate you talking about this situation and bringing light to it and certainly giving us some great tips this morning as well.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
Absolutely. Virginia Maxwell again here on WICC. It's interesting because a couple of weeks ago we saw that there was a lawsuit filed against Twitter for saying no more remote work. And just yesterday, the Washington Post had an article. It was titled "The Great Mismatch: Remote Jobs Are in Demand, but Positions Are Drying Up." So we're going to talk this morning a little bit about the remote work struggle here in Connecticut and across the country with Gary Phelan. He is back this morning from Quinnipiac University. He's also a partner at Mitchell & Sheehan in Stratford, which that firm practice is focused on labor and employment law on behalf of employers and employees. So, Gary, welcome back. So glad to have you. How are you?
Good, Melissa. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you. First of all, Gary, have you personally seen lawsuits here in Connecticut having to do with remote work and being told, even though you did it during the last 2 years of COVID, you've got to come back to the office? It's not going to work anymore.
Well, I think, you know, it's hard to know necessarily what claims have been filed. I certainly haven't seen one that's high profile, but the issues are arising, particularly with respect to persons with disabilities involving remote work, and I have had a few of those matters.
Well, it's interesting in this article, Gary, which I know you also read out of the Washington Post, the thing that is you thought, or I should say we as a country, I think, thought was going to happen was we got so good at remote working. We realized that people are more productive at home, that they actually get more things done when they are remote. It saves them money on childcare. Sales were better for companies that let people work remotely. So it was interesting because we saw a lot of good come out of this remote working model, but now that we are back to semi-normal ways, if you want to call it that, just for a lack of a better term, there's almost this need for control by employers. That's what my understanding is this idea of, no, we need to see what you're doing. We need you here. We need to feel that essence of family in the office space. Like, what is the struggle here when we saw such great success overall from remote working?
I think the word you said of control is at the heart of it, because you know what is interesting is the quantifiable, measurable metrics are like stronger performance, saving money, saving time. But what's balancing off that is perception of things like we're losing our culture. There's not enough opportunity to collaborate. We don't have sort of the interpersonal experiences that we always had in the past. But a lot of it, you know, if it could be summed down to two things. One is the need for control. The other is resistance to change.
Ooh, so like archaic almost. Like, hey, this is the way it's always been, so we're not going to change it now. If it's not broken, don't fix it.
Correct. And the idea that we're going back to normal, even though normal may not have been the best option, it's what's known.
So we're talking this morning to Gary Phelan. And again, Gary comes on our show every couple of weeks. He is a great reference point when it comes to employer and employee law. He is, he does teach over at Quinnipiac University, but he's also a partner at Mitchell & Sheehan in Stratford. And so we're talking about remote working. What about the lawsuit that was filed by Twitter? Let's go back to that example a couple of weeks ago, the idea of no more remote work. I know you had mentioned we've seen from your perspective and probably many other attorneys in Connecticut, we've seen people say, hey, you know what, because of my disability, remote work is working for me. But for other folks who maybe there's no disability at all, they're just like, hey, this model works better for me. I'm at home. I get my work done in a quicker fashion. I can get to doctor's appointments. I'm not asking for a half a day off to get out. So it worked better for them. So the idea of staying at the company they've always been at, but it now has to go back into the office is not ideal. Tell us a little bit about that, because, again, there's no disability per se. It's just that they like that model a lot better and it worked for the last 2 years. So why go backwards?
Well, the Twitter lawsuit, again, working from home, made that business decision to eliminate that. That's since been modified for, quote unquote, exceptional employees. But working from home is a key reasonable accommodation. That was an option before the pandemic, certainly not as utilized. now is seen as being much more reasonable. But what we're seeing, and I think what people are experiencing, is there were definitely advantages to parents, particularly of younger children, for people with elder care responsibilities, and for just flexibility. Now, the employer, except for persons with disabilities, there's no legal right.
That's what I was going to get at, is could you even really file a lawsuit? Because if the employer never said, hey, this is going to be a permanent remote job, can they really even be found liable for doing anything wrong if they say, no, you're coming back to the office full time?
That's, you know, you're right. That other than for people with disabilities, there's really no legal claims.
Mm.
And so the problem we're facing, and, you know, kind of the conflict we're navigating, is, you know, as said in that Washington Post article, you know, that it's hard to put the genie back in the bottle.
Yeah.
People have now experienced the advantages and the flexibility of working from home, and now having that taken away once they experienced it, particularly where there seems to be no good business case for taking it away, is causing a lot of conflict. I think the irony is that a tech company with very, you know, like Twitter is the one really that's become the, you know, the real leader in removing working from home, when you think they have the most technological ability to work from home.
What's challenging about this, though, Gary, is in that article from the Washington Post, it says that while there are so many jobs available right now, like the market is hot, finding remote working jobs is not. It's very hard to find those kinds of jobs right now. So do you, in your professional opinion, do you think there's going to hit sort of a peak where people are like, hey, we're jumping ship, we want to go back to remote work? Like, do you think it will get to a point where maybe not all, but many employers go, wait a minute, we've lost some really good talent, and instead of paying for new people, because again, signing bonuses are not as big as they used to be, and a lot of the things that were being offered during COVID are kind of subsided at this point. So do you believe that employers will get to a point where they're like, hey, you know what, this was so not worth it, this was not worth sticking to our guns for really quality workers, who are now like, hey, you know what, I'd rather go 6 months unemployed and find remote work than to stay with the company I've been with?
You know, I think what we're seeing now is going to continue to be a trend.
Mm.
As the article pointed out, there's the number of people who are applying for jobs on LinkedIn is 50% of the applicants are for remote positions, and yet only 15% of the jobs available are remote.
Yeah.
I think we're seeing employers pulling back, and the, you know, the pendulum, which was worked toward employees throughout the pandemic because of not having enough workers, due to the need, you know, to work from home. That pendulum is swinging back with layoffs, with smaller pay increases. And so I think employers, again, going back to the word control, now want to, you know, sort of pull back the reins on working from home. And I think this trend is going to continue. The unfortunate part of that is that it's really opened the door, working from home, for people with disabilities, people with caregiving responsibilities, and also for getting better applicants.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the one thing is with having remote positions, you're opening it up to a larger pool.
Yeah, it's true.
Of individuals. Mm-hmm. But again, I don't think that I think what we're seeing now is going to continue, which is kind of pulling back the remote work option.
Mm. Gary Phelan, such great insight into this, and it will be interesting to see what happens. Certainly, if you're an employer who is debating having remote work options, I think you're in a better position to find, like you said, that larger pool of applicants and more options to find the very best, because there's a high demand for it, and a lot of businesses are just not willing to break the, hey, this is what we've always done historically, so we're going to stick with it, and we'll take the risk of losing people. But if you're willing to do remote working options, you'd be surprised how many people are more on board to do that. Now, of course, there are some industries that can't. If you have to do physical labor, things like that, there you literally don't really have that option of remote work. But it's an interesting conversation. So I thank you so much for having it here on WICC.
Oh, thank you, Melissa.
All right, you too. Gary Phelan here, again, from Quinnipiac University and the partner at Mitchell & Sheehan in Stratford on WICC.